As Gary Courtney started the engines of the Queen Air, he was calculating furiously. Capricorn was almost 60 miles closer to the showgrounds than Firgrove, and in addition the Queen Air was 70 or 80 knots faster than the Centurion at the cruise. It was 7 minutes since Sean had called him, 9 minutes since Mickey had taken off. It was all running very close. He dared not try to guess where to intercept the Centurion and try to cut its track. There was only one sure course open to him. He had to fly directly to the showgrounds, then turn and head back on the reciprocal of Michael's heading. He had to risk everything on a head-on interception. As he opened the throttles and ran the Queen Air out onto the runway, he found with mild surprise that he still had a half-smoked cigar between his teeth. In the panic of getting to the aircraft, he had forgotten all about it. As he lifted the big twin-engined machine into the air, he drew deeply on the cigar. It was the very best Havana, and he smiled at the irony. The fragrant smoke calmed his nerves a little. "I'm not as good at this as Sean is," he spoke to himself. "Give me a hectic day on the stock exchange or a nice bloody takeover deal any day." He pushed the Queen Air right over the manual, squeezing an extra 15 knots out of her. He picked out the showgrounds from almost 7 miles out. A pod of giant balloons floated above it like colourful whales. The vast car parks were aglitter with reflected sunlight from thousands of vehicles. He turned back onto a direct heading for Firgrove and leant forward in his seat, peering ahead through the windscreen and puffing on the fat cigar. He was still running calculations of speed and time and distance through his head. "If I'm going to meet them, then it should be 5 or 6 minutes," he broke off, as a beam of sunlight reflected from something ahead and below and caught his eye. He pushed his horn-rimmed spectacles up on his nose, once again hating his weak, myopic eyes, and peered fretfully down, trying to find it again. He had left the built-up residential area behind, and was flying over the open countryside, studded with small villages and crisscrossed with roads. The patterns of ploughed lands and plantations of trees disturbed his eye, and threw up 100 decoys and optical tricks to confuse him. He searched frantically, sweeping the open sky briefly, and then concentrating on the earth below. He expected the Centurion to be well under him. He saw the shadow first. It flitted and jumped like a grasshopper across the fields. A moment later he saw the tiny blue aircraft. It was 1,000 feet below him and 2 miles directly ahead. He pushed the nose of the Air Queen down into a dangerous altitude and dived to intercept. The two aircraft were converging at almost 500 knots, and before Gary could get the Queen Air down to the same altitude as the Centurion, it had passed like a blue flash below him. Gary hauled up one wing into a maximum rate turn and came round behind the Centurion. He used the Queen Air's superior speed and the dive to overhaul the smaller craft. "We'll be there in about 10 minutes, Michael warned Ramon. "You'd better get ready." Ramon leant forward and reached down to the gaudily painted cylinders, bolted to the floorboards between his feet. Carefully he opened the tap on the neck of each of the bottles. He felt the rush of internal pressure, checked immediately by the gate of the main valve in the connecting T-piece. Now it needed only to thumb the valve lever across, half a turn in an anti-clockwise direction, to send the mixed and activated gas hissing into the long nose and spraying out through the nozzle under the Centurion's belly. Ramon straightened up and glanced across at Michael in the pilot's seat beside him. "All set," he began, and then broke off and stared with astonishment through the side window beside Michael's head. An enormous silver fuselage filled the entire frame of the window. Another aircraft was flying wingtip to wingtip with them, and the pilot peered across at them. He was a large, baby-faced man with dark, horn-rimmed glasses and the stub of his cigar clamped in one corner of his mouth. "Gary!" shouted Michael in consternation. Gary lifted his right hand and stabbed downwards with his thumb, an unmistakable gesture. Instinctively, Michael flung the Centurion into a tight, descending turn and dropped away towards the earth like a stone. He levelled out just above the treetops. He glanced in his rearview mirror and saw the Queen Air's round silver nose 100 yards from his tail and closing rapidly. He hauled the Centurion up and around hard, but the moment he levelled out, the silver machine loomed up beside him. Garry had always been a far better pilot than he was, and the Queen Air had the wings to outfly him.
"I can't get away from him."
"Fly straight for the target," Ramon ordered brusquely. "There is nothing he can do." Michael had hoped that Ramon would abandon the operation now, but reluctantly he turned back onto his original track. He was down to 200 feet above the tops of the tallest trees. Garry followed him round and came up alongside him. Their wingtips were only a yard apart. Once again, Garry signalled him to land. Instead, Michael snatched up the microphone of his radio, knowing that Garry would be tuned to 118.7 megahertz.
"I'm sorry, Garry," he cried. "I have to do it. I'm sorry."
Garry's voice boomed through the radio speaker into the cabin. "Land immediately, Mickey. It's not too late. We can still get you out of this. Don't be a fool, man." Michael shook his head vehemently and pointed ahead. Garry's expression hardened. He dropped back, and before Michael could react, he slid in sideways and thrust the Queen Air's wingtip under the Centurion's tail. Then he came back hard on the control wheel and flicked the smaller plane's tail up, so she tumbled forward into an almost vertical dive. The Centurion was too low and the dive too steep for Michael to recover before he hit the top branches of a tall blue gum tree. Michael threw up his hands as he saw it coming, but a dry branch as thick as a man's arm stabbed through the windscreen that had been weakened by Sean's bullet. The point of the branch caught Michael at the base of his throat. It found the notch between his collarbones and went through with the ease of a hypodermic needle, transfixing his upper torso and coming out between his shoulder blades. The momentum of the falling aircraft snapped the branch off, and the jagged butt protruded from his throat like an ugly, twisted lance. The Centurion drove on, crashing and crackling through the treetops. First one wing, then the other, were ripped away, breaking the aircraft's speed, until it fell clear of the trees and the wingless fuselage hit the ground and bounced and skidded to rest at the edge of a field of standing maize stalks. Ramon Machado dragged himself upright in the seat, amazed that he was still alive. He looked across at Michael. Michael's mouth was wide open in a silent shriek. The jagged branch stuck out of his throat, and a fountain of his blood spurted over the remains of the shattered windscreen. Ramon released the catch of his seatbelt and tried to lift himself out of his seat. He found himself anchored, and he looked down. His left leg was broken. It was twisted like a piece of boiled spaghetti between the seat and the gas cylinders. The leg of his trousers was ripped up to the knee, and the stainless steel valve handle was buried deeply in the flesh of his calf. As he stared at it, he became aware of the faint hiss of escaping gas. His leg had twisted the valve handle into the open position. Syndex 25 was spurting into the hose and spraying from the nozzle under the fuselage. Ramon grabbed at the door handle and threw all his weight upon it. It was jammed solid. He placed both hands under the knee of his injured leg and hauled upon it, trying to pull it free. The leg elongated, and he heard the ends of shattered bone shards grate together deep in his flesh, but it was held inexorably, as in a bear trap, by the stainless steel valve handle. Suddenly he smelt the odour of almonds. His nostrils began to burn and sting. Silver mucus flooded from both nostrils and drooled over his lips and down his chin. In their sockets his eyes turned to coals of fire, and his vision dimmed. In the darkness the agony assailed him. It surpassed any conception that he had ever had of pain. He began to scream. He screamed and screamed and screamed, sitting in a puddle of his own urine and feces, until at last his lungs collapsed, and he could scream no more. Santon Courtney Malcolmes sat on a fallen log at the edge of the forest and watched the puppy and the child at play. The puppy was the pick of Dandylas of Veltefrieden's last litter, before Santon had been forced to have the gallant old bitch put down. The puppy had inherited all her mother's best points. She would be a champion also. Santon was convinced of it. Nicky was working her with an old silk stocking stuffed with guinea fowl feathers. He learnt as quickly as the puppy. He seemed to have a way with dogs and horses. "It's in his blood," Santin thought complacently. "He's a true Courtney, despite the name and the fancy Spanish title." She went on to think of her other Courtneys. Tomorrow, Shaza and Elsa Pignatelli were marrying in the little slave church that Santin had so lovingly restored. It would be one of the biggest weddings to be held in the Cape of Good Hope for at least a decade. Guests were coming from England and Europe and Israel and America. There would have been a time not so many years ago when Santin would have wanted to make all the plans and supervise all the preparations for the wedding herself. Now she was content to leave it all to Bella and Elsa Pignatelli. "Let them get on with it," she told herself firmly. "I've got my hands full with my roses and my dogs and Nicky." She thought about Bella. Bella was contrite and chastened, but Santin was not satisfied that it was enough. She had debated long and hard with herself and with Shaza, before at last agreeing to cover for the girl, and shield her from the full consequences of her treason and the righteous fury of the law. Still, she has a penance to perform. Grimly, Santin justified her leniency. Isabella will dedicate the rest of her life to making amends. She owes a lifetime of service to every member of this family and to all the people of this wonderful land of ours whom she betrayed. "I'll see to it that she pays all her debts in full," she thought purposefully, and then turned to watch the puppy find the feather bag that Nicky had hidden in the reeds down by the stream, the puppy's long, silky tail waving like a triumphant banner as she came to deliver it to her young master. At last the boy and the dog came to sit at her feet together, and Nicky put one tan, bare arm around the puppy's neck and hugged her. "Have you decided on a name for her yet?" Santin asked. It had taken her almost 2 years to break down the child's resistance to her, but she felt that now she had at last won him over from his memories of Adra and his previous life. "Yes, Nana. I want to call her 26. Nicky's English had improved vastly since she had enrolled him at Western Province Junior School. "That is an unusual name. Why did you choose it?" "I had another dog once. He was called 26. And yet Nicky's memories of that other time had almost faded. "Well, that is an excellent reason, and it's a fine name. Dandy 26 of Veltefrieden." "Yes, yes," Nicky hugged the puppy's neck. "Dandy 26. Santin looked down on him fondly. He was still a mixed-up and confused little boy, but he was a thoroughbred with the blood of champions in his veins. "Give us time," she thought. "Just give me a little more time with him." "Shall I tell you a story, Nicholas?" she asked. She had the most wonderful family stories, of elephant hunts and lions, of wars with Boers and Zulus and Germans, of lost diamond mines and of fighter planes and a thousand other things to thrill the soul of a small boy. So now she told him a story of shipwreck and of a castaway on a burning shore. She told him of a journey through a cruel desert with little yellow pixies as companions, and he walked every step of the enchanted way beside them. At last she looked at her wristwatch and said, "That's enough for today, young Master Nicholas. Your mother will be wondering whatever has become of us." Nicholas sprang up to help her to her feet, and the two of them walked down the hill towards the big house with the puppy gambolling around them. They walked quite slowly, because Nana had a sore leg, and Nicky took her hand to help her over the rough places.